Thank you, Tim. Good to be with you all again this Lord's Day. Well, again, I'm going to bring out my old stuff and use it again. And I realize that for many of you, it's going to be new stuff because you haven't been here that many years. And so, just kind of getting it dusted off and prepared for my gospel meeting on Providence. And tonight's lesson is going to come from the story of Esther, or the book of Esther. As we see there, we've looked at the first two lessons, David and Moses. Those are men of God, used by God in His providence. And now we'll see tonight a woman of God, used in His great providing for His people. I've titled the lesson, For Such a Time as This. And I thought that's just such an eloquent way that Mordecai had to describe God's providence. For such a time as this, because if you think about it, each one of us live in the present hour, and this is our time in this day, as long ago it was for Esther and her day. And it's upon us to remember that and to seek to be faithful to God, understanding that He knows the plan, and we are just to be servants of His, useful for His kingdom. So we're going to look at the story today of a beautiful woman, one who lost her mother and father, one who had obstacles, great obstacles to overcome. Some have referred to it as the star story because it is filled with kings and queens and princes and palaces, but also because the name Esther is the Persian word for star. And here is this woman that lives a difficult life and finds in the end that it was productive and profitable for the household of God. Now, Esther is crucial, I believe, to our understanding of how God works today. In the time of the patriarchs, God spoke directly to the heads of the house. Afterward, He would speak through Moses and then the prophets, oftentimes using miracles. But by the time of Esther, He would work primarily through providence. This is the time where they're really near the 400 years of silence. So there'd be a number of centuries that would go by where God would work in this particular way. And as we know, God is not mentioned in this book. That is the letters G-O-D. And yet it's a book that so clearly shows God on it in every page of every line, right? Not by miracles, but by providence, by providence. Again, let me remind you, providence comes from a Latin word meaning to foresee. You can also see the word provide in the word providence. When you combine those two ideas, you get a very good grasp of what providence is. It's God foreseeing and then providing for what He sees. Webster defines it as divine guidance or care. God conceived as the power sustaining and guiding human destiny. God is the power sustaining it and guiding it. And so that is a definition of providence. But I believe the book Esther does a good job of making it easier, this deep subject. So let's begin in chapter 1. The star story starts here with first, another woman, actually. A woman who had the courage to stand as well. And there, chapter 1, verse 1, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was Ahasuerus who reigned over the 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that is, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. So we come upon a scene of a massive feast that had been taking place for some time. Ahasuerus is the king. You might have a side marginal note saying the name Xerxes. That is also another name for the same king. He reigned from India to Ethiopia. And so it's a very large territory, a massive kingdom. The king was known very well throughout history, even secular history. His cruelty was unmatched. He was all about conquering territory. And this feast would last 180 days because he was about to send these men off to war. And for many of them, it'll be the last time that they will see their loved ones. And so you see verse 4, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. So the king was preparing his men for battle, the kingdom for battle. It was going to be a very important battle because this time what we understand is that he wants to advance the army into Greece. Perhaps you've heard of the very famous story of the 300 Spartans that would try to hold off the Persian army from destroying Greece, trying to bottleneck the great Persian army between a rock and a hard place, we might say. Well, Xerxes was that king that was trying to conquer Greece. And had he been successful, some say we would have never learned what democracy was since it had its birthplace in Greece. Whether that's so or not, I don't know. But Ahasuerus or Xerxes put on this feast, and in the last 7 days of it, while drunk with wine, he calls for his queen to come in and essentially to prance and parade around for all the men to see. But she's not going to have anything with it. Verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials. For she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Men will do things when they're affected by alcohol that they probably wouldn't do if they were sober. Girls need to understand this. Your morality and modesty is affected by alcohol. The timing that you take to stop a car, the inhibitions are all lowered, affected by alcohol. Things are different under the influence of alcohol. Vashti was one that recognized this. She wasn't engaged in this kind of beauty pageant with sinful nakedness that would take place all before these drunk men. Girls, do you understand and know what it's like for a man when you exploit or expose your body? Vashti knew, and that's why she refused. Now remember, this is a pagan woman, a worldly woman, and yet she knew how the world operates. We need more, sometimes Christian women, that have the decency and morality of this worldly woman. She says, I ain't going to do this. And the king was furious. Furious that she would not obey. And so what takes place is they demote her because she didn't obey the king. Verse 19, they say, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him and let it be recorded in the laws of the Medes and Persians, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So this all just sets the scene. It's the background, the background story of the why of Esther, why she be brought in. They have to find another queen. So again, we think about the great providence of God, and for such a time as this, we see he even operates among those in the world to bring about his plan to accomplish his will. Exit one queen so that he might enter in another one with the right background. And so chapter 2, we see that this search would begin. Verse 4, then let the young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, let me just say something here real quick. What we're studying in Jeremiah, there in some way starts to connect to what we see here in Esther. Jeconiah would be a king under the time in which Jeremiah would be prophesying. saying that Babylon's going to come. Babylon's going to carry you away. Well, fast forward into time, into the story of Esther, that had taken place. And we see a man named Kish had been taken. And from Kish would come these relatives, one being Mordecai. Mordecai. Now, verse 7 says, "And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." So this tells a little bit about the one that would be raising her. A little bit about Mordecai. He's a man of benevolence. He is going to raise her as his own. She will be, as in essence, his adopted daughter, though he would ultimately be the older cousin to Esther. But he would raise her to know God and take her into his attention. He would care for her. But in time, things change. You know, we might like things to always stay the same. But yet then something comes that tragically shakes the family apart. And verse 8 says, "So it was when the king commanded and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women." You'll notice that she didn't volunteer. The scripture says she was taken. This was not something that I believe that her or Mordecai would have hoped for or planned for. But the decree had went out from the king. And, well, law just took over. There's a beautiful woman in this house over here down by the citadel. Oh, we spotted her out. Okay, yes, she's going to have to come along with us. I'm sorry, we're taking her. And so Esther also was taken, the Bible says. Now, before she's taken, Mordecai gives her some words of wisdom that she would do well to heed. Verse 10, it says, "Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it." In essence, don't tell everybody about our background, who we are. Don't expose yourself to that kind of danger, for we are a downcast people. We're not respected. We're the minority group in this area. So verse 11, "And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her." He still cared for her while she was gone. He still hoped to be able to see her from time to time, or if he couldn't, at least hear a word of how she is doing. So how was she doing? Well, verse 12 says, "Each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation, according to the regulation for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months worth of oil and myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women." Could you imagine that? I mean, that's... I understand sometimes people go to beauty school to learn how to make somebody else look beautiful, right? But here she is taking 12 months of manicures and pedicures and facials and perfume. I mean, I don't know how your head is staying on straight with all of that being put on you and the pampering that's taking place. And yet that's exactly what happened, not only for her, but all those that were potential candidates to be the next queen that would replace Vashti. Well, we learned that in time, the king takes notice of Esther. Verse 17 says, "The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king." So she is selected as the next queen of Persia. And they make a great feast in honor of her name, the feast of Esther. You know, a lot of young people, something like that would go to their heads, become very full of themselves, maybe very prideful. But we'll learn that Esther kept her humility. We'll learn that Esther still sought to honor Mordecai, her adopted father. And we need to take note of that, young people. You'll notice there in verse 20, "Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him." So young people, as you grow up and gain more independence as you age, you're going to become more and more frustrated with your parents and the things that they have kind of outlined for you in terms of rules and responsibilities, things that you're allowed to do and things that you're not allowed to do. You might say, it just doesn't make sense to me. Well, let me tell you, if you want to be a star in God's eyes, as Esther was, then you're going to trust and obey the judgment of your parents just as Esther did. Even when she was lifted up, she didn't see herself all of a sudden as wiser and more capable than her adopted father. She still wanted to honor him. She still wanted to obey him. She trusted his judgment. For such a time as this, and this is key for us to get in the providence of God, if we truly want to be used to our greatest potential to God, then we must be faithful and obedient. And that starts first with our own parents. Trust me, it's not because your parents hate you and they don't appreciate you and don't want the best for you. It's because they love you. They love you more than their lives themselves, and they want to try and raise you up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord that you might be given to God in great service. That was Mordecai's desire for Esther. And that's every parent's here desire for their parents as well. So it starts first with being obedient to your parents. It was Jesus who said, "He who is faithful in little will be faithful in much." You want to be faithful to God in much? Be faithful in little. Obey your parents. Remember David? We studied last week. Before he fought Goliath, he first fought what? The lions and the bears, didn't he? So again, question yourselves. Do you want to be used in service to God to the greatest of your ability? Then think about Esther, for she's about to be used greatly. And here we see her character. Here we see her heart. She honored her adopted father. Now verse 21 says, "In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name." So we got to pause to make this point here. The Bible kind of turns away from Esther for a moment to Mordecai and him and discovering this conspiracy, this assassination plot. He hears about it, and so he goes and tells the FBI, and they find it to be so, and they're going to incriminate these individuals. Verse 23, "And when inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." And so just a little marginal note here, in essence, it's logged in the Chronicles of the king. Just put that in the back of your mind. Just a little detail. The secretary that day, what did they do? They said, expose Bigthan and Teresh. Put them to death. Oh yeah, Mordecai pointed this problem out. End of day, period, right? What may have been less than significant was going to prove to be vital in the providence of God for such a time as this. And that might be good for us to remember. When we think about our little insignificant things that take place in a day, it behooves us to remember that the days are not individual units, more rather like links in a chain, one after the other. Now we come to chapter 3, and we see that the king promotes one. Verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So this man named Haman, he gets the promotion of promotions. You can almost see him coming home that day. Hey, honey, you're not going to believe it. I got the dream job. We're really on our way now. I don't know what it is, but often when a man gets a new position, he can also slightly start to nudge the position of his attitude. He can become arrogant, haughty, thinking more of himself than he ought to think. Maybe he's the big shot now. And what once was a humble guy becomes a downright ugly guy. I don't know why it is that double pay often means double pride. And it's sad. And that's certainly going to be the case for this man, Haman. What we learn in verse 2 is that all feed that pride. Verse 2 says, and all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. So they all begin to bow and fall before him. Oh, you're just so great, Mordecai. Haman. But Mordecai would not do that. He would not follow suit. He would not. He could not. He should not. And why is that? Well, we learn at the end of verse 4, he's asked, actually, why do you transgress the king's command in verse 3? So verse 4, it happened, it says, when they spoke to him daily, he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told him that he was a Jew. This is, in essence, the reason why he wouldn't do it. It's for religious reasons. I cannot do that. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I don't have anything against the guy. I'm not that kind of a person. I am a Jew. When you think about why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wouldn't fall before the great image of the king, it wasn't because they didn't regard the king. It's because they were a Jew. They would worship and serve no idol. And that really is what's taking place with Haman, this kind of homage that they're paying. Well, that didn't satisfy Haman. He let it eat at him. And I want to tell you that sometimes we can do that as well. When something doesn't quite go our way, everything else might be going right. I mean, we could be in health, our family could be doing well, you know, we're still got a job, we're getting paid, you know, we've got blessings, God has showered us with, but there's this one thing that just bugs us, and it just eats at us, and we forget about everything else, and that one thing we just can't let go. It tears us up on the inside. And I want to tell you, look where that leads Haman in the end. Don't be a Haman. Don't be like that. Verse 5 says, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, and he began to plan. He began to conspire. Verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. I'm going to get them all. For they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. There's individuals that do that, and we sometimes call it racism, right? Maybe one of a particular class or a particular skin color has shown dishonor, disrespect, or just downright ugliness, or hurt one. And that person then holds it against all of that same race, even though those other individuals have not done anything to them at all. In fact, could be rather kind towards that person. They paint with a broad brush. You know, Hitler would seek to eliminate and exterminate all the Jews. Right? That's what Haman's going to try to do. Didn't like this ethnic background anymore. He didn't want them to be around anymore. And so he begins to plot. Now, verse 8. Then Haman said to the king, to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain." Notice he's very generic as to who they are, you know, details. He's just generally painting this picture. It doesn't sound good. It's kind of like the nightly news, right? They just paint this skew, the picture in their direction they want you to see. So he says, verse 9, "If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." So he says, listen, kings, there's rebels, there's spies that don't obey your laws. I mean, what would you do? You think about it. If you're the king and your second in command comes to you and said this, "We've got this problem, king, but don't worry, I have a plan. We can destroy them, and guess how good this plan is. In so doing, I'll put about $20 billion in the king's coffers. You're going to make money from this, not lose money. I can take care of this." And the king says, "Well, I don't really know about all of this, but you go ahead and take care of this. I'm busy. You go on." So verse 11. Well, verse 10, "So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman." Then verse 11, "The king said to Haman, 'The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. So you just take care of this little problem for me, Haman. I trust you. I trust you.'" So it was just a blip on the radar screen of Xerxes' day, but it was doomsday for the Jews. And so the board is set for providence to play out and courage to be tested. Verse 1 of chapter 4. "When Mordecai learned all that happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry." Mordecai gets wind of this and he mourns like he's never mourned before. Right? Doom and death to all the Jews. Now Esther hears about this and she's concerned for Mordecai and she sends him some clothes and finds out what's going on. What's the problem? Verse 4, "So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth away from him, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hacheth." I looked it up this evening. "Hacheth, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was." What's going on, Mordecai? Well, what's going on is that Haman's going to kill and wipe out all the Jews. And he proposes that this will make the kingdom very wealthy. And so he sends word back, "Go and tell Esther these words." Verse 6, "So Hacheth went to Mordecai in the city square that was in the front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given at Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her." See, here's the proof. Look at this. Here's what's going to happen. "And that he might command her to go into the king to make supplication to him and plead before him for her people." Oh, Esther, you've got to handle this. You've got to take care of this. Tell the king. Whew. This is some heavy stuff. This is some heavy stuff. Well, Esther spoke to Hatach and gave him command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go in to see the king these 30 days. And so they told Mordecai Esther's words. What is she doing here? She's saying, in essence, like, are you sure about this? Listen, this, I don't know about this plan. This isn't, there's just one law, those that go and disturb the king, and that's to put them to death. She's afraid, and I think with good reason. I think if we were in the same place, we would be afraid as well. Well, that doesn't settle it for Mordecai. There's more on the line than just her one life. Mordecai, verse 13, told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." So just because you're there doesn't mean you're going to escape the death penalty when this goes into effect a year from now. Verse 14, "For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." There's his faith. He trusted God would somehow, some way, save the people. But he says, "You and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this." There's those words. There's those words. And we read them, and we put in our emotion, our feeling, and we think, yes, those are inspiring words. Well, how's she going to respond? Oh, yes, I'm glad to hear that. I can do this now. Let's go. I remember reading one commentary, and they quoted Winston Churchill when he learned that he must command the British Army against the Nazis, saying maybe Esther felt like Winston Churchill at that particular time. And they quoted him. He said, "At last I had the authority to give directions of the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." I'll be honest, I don't think that's what Esther was thinking. Probably more like, "Oh no, what am I going to do? Oh no." I know that's less dramatic, but I think that's probably more realistic. And it's why she had sent back word the first time to Mordecai, "Don't you know the king's command about this kind of a thing?" Most likely, Esther might have felt like, "Why are all these bad things happening to me?" And I think that is a key takeaway in understanding the providence of God. It usually is happening in the very moments that you don't think are too providential. When you look back on the life of Esther, I counted the bad things that happened to her up to this point, and there's at least five things that I count that one would never wish to happen to them. You might say, what are those five? Well, one being her parents died. Do you know how painful that would be? To be orphaned? To not be raised by your mother? To not be raised by your father? No, we would choose, if we had a choice, to be raised by our mother and father, wouldn't we? But Esther didn't have that choice. But that providentially led her to be raised by Mordecai. The second thing is that she was taken to the palace, not by choice. She was forced to leave her loving surroundings for strange and new surroundings. Again, that probably wouldn't have been her choice. I'd rather be at home with Mordecai. I love Mordecai. He loves me. But she was taken. That wouldn't seem too providential. Thirdly, a very powerful man begins to hate her adopted father, Mordecai. You know, it might have felt better if somebody lesser, if a servant hated Mordecai. Why does it have to be the second in command? That wouldn't seem too providential. Then, fourthly, this man decides to have a Holocaust and to wipe out every single Jew from the face of the earth. Again, doesn't feel providential. And then fifthly, now she's being advised to go into the king's palace where the king only has one law for any that appear before him without being called, and that is death. Now there's an exception, but that's an exception. The rule is death. Five things that one would perceive as bad things in one's life. And yet, it's for such a time as this. God's providence is working when you think it is not, when you think He's truly forgotten you. But it's not true. There are many instances, I believe, in the lives of godly women where they might think that God has forgotten them. But I want to especially point out that among preachers' wives, I believe that sensation can feel very true, where they can feel very alone. Often they have to be the one that supports and upholds the evangelist, the preacher. So many people will come to him, and oftentimes she gets the leftovers. I've been so blessed to have such a good wife to not only take care of me, but to take care of the home and to take care of the kids, that often her good duties, her good works gets overlooked, not just by members of the church, but even by her own family, because we're all so in the mode of things that have to be done. And it might feel, I don't know, you'd have to ask Julie, but not too providential that you ended up in a marriage or relationship like that. Looking back, would you have chosen those very things? And yet, God has placed even these women in these particular roles to be a great needed support, that the job really ultimately couldn't be done without them. They are so needed, as an Esther was needed at this particular time for God's people. So too are preachers' wives often needed for God's people. Notice I didn't just say for God's spokesman or God's preacher. Because oftentimes a church can lose its soundness when they begin to lose the soundness of a preacher. Now, it shouldn't be that way. A church should still stand. But you and I know that there's instances where that takes place. Pray for the preacher's wives. Encourage them and their work that often gets overlooked, that may not feel very providential. Understand, it's for such a time as this. So here's Esther with things that have unfolded in her life that didn't seem providential. And yet you and I know, because we have the story here, it is providential. But she was living the story, right? She wasn't writing it. She was living it. And in those moments, minute by minute, second by second, it didn't feel that way. So what are you going to do, Esther? What's going to take place? She does a big gulp, right? Okay, verse 16. She tells him, "Go and gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Notice how she puts that there. She recognizes that this is the strongest likely outcome. Now let's try to work against that by praying and fasting. Let's all do this together. I'm going to go, but if I'm going to die, then that's just the outcome. I'm going to die. And she's willing to accept that. What bravery, what courage. She's fighting against those fears. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So day one passes. Day two begins to pass. It's drawing near its end. Could you see Esther out there looking out from the palace porch, wondering if this is the last sunset that she will see? Then finally the third day comes, and she enters the king's court. What's going to happen? Verse 1, chapter 5. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house. While the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. And so it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court. Time stands still, right? This is the moment. This is the hour. What shall he do? She found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. Oh, that must have felt like an eternity had passed. We talked about some of that before, when time seems to stand still. And so it did for her. But now she's received the scepter. She's received grace and mercy. And she touches the scepter. And he says in verse 3, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." And so what does she request? Well, verse 4 and 5, she says, "Oh, if it pleases the king, won't you come, and Haman come to a banquet? I'll prepare, and then I'll let you know my request." So verse 5, the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Whew. Okay, so she's now got the audience of the king, an audience with Haman. Surely she wouldn't have risked her life for just a banquet. There's something she wants to share, something she wants to talk about. And so the occasion is granted. Verse 6, at the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom it shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this." Can you see her? Her heart's beating faster, perhaps getting flushed at this moment. Now she has to say it. Will she say it? Verse 8, "If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I'll prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." You ever had one of those moments where you get nervous, your mouth gets dry, your throat gets parched? I kind of imagine this would have been a kind of a scary moment for her as well. And so she bails. She bails. She's okay. Come tomorrow. Let's do this again tomorrow. And then I'll share my request. "Well, okay," the king says. "We'll do it tomorrow." And so she puts it off for one more day. Well, the scene now changes as Haman leaves the banquet. We learn from the Bible that he leaves on cloud 9. In his mind, his stock has risen so high. Only he and the king and queen at this banquet. No one else. Oh, he feels great about all of this. Verse 9, "So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart." But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Oh, he's so upset, right? But look at the circumstances. Look at everything from his standpoint so far. Everything's great. Nothing could be going better for him in his life. But there's this one guy who just won't do what he wants him to do. And he just can't get him off his mind. Friends, that's a grudge. And if you let something go long enough, it'll eat at you the same way. Everything can be great, but that one thing, don't be a Haman. That's what Scripture's trying to tell us about here. Look what his grudge gets him to do. He gets home, verse 10, verse 11, he calls his family, calls his wife in, and he talks about all these great things. Oh, look at this. He says, verse 11, you know, king's promoted him. He's advanced above all the other officials, the servants of the king. Verse 12, besides, the Queen Esther's invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet. I mean, I am doing great, but I'm not. Verse 13, yet all this avails me nothing. So long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate, what do I do about him? Verse 14, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends say to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Wow. Now, we just talked about how a good wife can help a good man. How I can't do my work without my dear wife, Julie. But we also can see a bad wife can destroy a bad man as well. If she had been the kind of woman that she should have been, she would have reminded him that his thoughts of bitterness will lead to your downfall, Haman. Ignore that little Mordecai. Forget that Mordecai. Look at all that you have. Look how high you've climbed. Don't let this one little man bring you down. Let it go. He's a nobody. He's a bellhop. Let it go. That's what a good wife would have done for him. But instead, she encourages him in his hate. Hate leads to murder. Let's kill him. Build a gallows. And so he commands the servants, and he can begin to hear the hammers and the nails, right? As they begin to raise this tremendous gallows near his house. And so the construction project begins at night. And he thinks at morning, I'm going to get the okay, I'm going to get the approval, the stamp of approval from the king to do this. Now the scene turns away from Haman and opens up with the king. That same night, we learned that the king could not sleep. We see God's providence at work in this part of the story again as well, don't we? We've all had restless nights, sleepless nights. So when those nights happen, what do we do sometimes? We reach for a book, don't we? And surely there's no cure for the insomnia like the Chronicles. And that's what he asked to be read. Chapter 6, 1. That night the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. All right. So they're reading, hoping to make him nod off to sleep and begin to saw logs. Friends, you recognize there is nothing miraculous about what is taking place here, right? This is just called ordinary living. And what happens next is nothing miraculous either. This is providence. Though the king has no idea, and neither would we if we were in that same moment as the king. So verse 2. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Well, then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So they're at the part of the Chronicles that happens, just so happens to talk about what Mordecai had done in foiling the assassin's plan to take the king's life. And it also so happened to be that nothing was done to honor Mordecai for this. Nothing. Now that was very heard of in any day and age. No reward, and the king is ashamed about this. And about this time, the daylight begins to approach. And the king says, "Who's in the court? You know who it happens to be? Haman." It just happens. It says, even words that way. Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. Isn't this beautiful? What do you see here in these four short verses? I see five extraordinary pieces of providence. Can you count them? Again, providence in contrast to miraculous. One, the king couldn't sleep that night. Two, he happens to ask for a book. Three, it happens to be the Chronicles and that they turned to the exact place and where Mordecai had saved the king's life. Four, it happened to be that no reward was given to Mordecai. Five, Haman happens to be the one entering the court at that time. Everyday living. There's no miracle being worked here. It's for such a time as this. "Who's my next appointment?" the king wonders. "Haman, perfect. Send him on in." Right? Now here's something very interesting. They are both coming together and they both happen to be thinking about the same person. Mordecai. Right? Mordecai is on the mind for both of them. The king wanted to magnify Mordecai while Haman wanted to mortify Mordecai. And what's the odds of all of that? I'd say it's pretty high. But that's the providence of God. God always works out things right on time, doesn't he? So the king asks, verse 5, Haman's here, standing in the court. Let him come in. Verse 6, Haman came in. The king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" What does Haman think? We don't have to guess. The Bible tells us. Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" He's so full of himself, right? "Ah, it's me. Oh, here's what I would do. Let's do this for whom the man, the king, wants to honor." Verse 8, "Let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse in which the king has ridden, with which a royal crest placed on his head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one who, of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man to whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback throughout the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Yeah, that's what we ought to do. This would be a great plan. And the king says, "I love it. I love it, Haman. So go ahead and get all those things together. Get the horse, get the robe, get all these things, and lead and honor Mordecai." What? That had to just make the heart of Haman just plummet. This, he's going to have to shout this for his bitter enemy? Yes. Verse 10, you see that? "The king said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robe, the horse, and do as you suggested, and do it for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you've spoken.' So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback throughout the city square and proclaimed before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Wow. "Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered." He is crushed by his envy and his hate, and he tells his family what had happened. And his wife said, "Uh-oh, things aren't looking good for you." They aren't. If Mordecai, verse 13, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. And about that time, the limo driver arrives. Verse 14, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Oh, hurry, it's time for you to join Esther and the king for dinner. Maybe he thinks, surely it can't get better. It can't get worse than this, right? It's got to get better from here. I can at least eat with the king and the queen and nobody else, right? Oh, but it's about to get a whole lot worse for Haman. So, we see that she has the dinner, verse 1. Verse 2, on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done." Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request." Okay, so she speaks this time. Spare us. Save us, right? Verse 4, "For we've been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." This shocks the king. King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? And where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" The king is so clueless as to what is taking place. And Esther said, can you see her in your mind's eye? The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. He probably turned as white as a bedsheet. And the king arose in his wrath, verse 7, from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. He has to go somewhere else to cool off because he is so upset. Meanwhile, Haman is just frightened. He stood before the queen, before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, "Save me." For he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. So here he is. He's pleading with Esther, begging Esther for his life. Let me be spared, please, please. And the king comes right back in while he's doing it. The king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine. Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was in his begging and his pleading. It almost kind of looked like an aggressive move. And the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house?" And listen, the bodyguards, the soldiers, they knew exactly what that tone of voice meant. It says, as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. They know he's a dead man. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." And the king said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. You know, the Persian gallows, the Babylonian gallows, they're not like the ones that we think of that we used in America in the past, you know, with the rope and the noose and hanging. The gallows were a straight spike, and one was impaled upon it. They laid the body on top of it. And as time would go on, as the body would rot and decay, it would slide further and further down those gallows. It was a brutal way to die. And that's how Haman died. On the very gallows he prepared for Mordecai. Well, what happens at the end of the story? Well, remember, they had already decreed that this would take place against the Jews a year from now. And so the queen then petitions the king, can we write something in contrast to that? And the king takes off his signet ring, chapter 8, verse 2, which he had given to Haman, and he gave it to who? Mordecai. You're now second in command. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. And they would write a contrasting decree where the Jews get to defend themselves and also have the help of the official government. Chapter 9, verse 2. Chapter 9, verse 3, excuse me. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because of the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. And they would be victorious over their enemies. Chapter 8 and verse 16. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree had come, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because of the fear of the Jews that fell upon them. And so the Jews were saved. 75,000 of Haman's henchmen would die, and the Jews would be victorious. And Mordecai and his great wealth and wisdom would be told of all the people, and God would be glorified for such a time as this. Friends, when we think about providence, it's a beautiful thing to think about. But it reminds us, when I think about the so what of providence, the so what, we have to recognize providence doesn't mean we can just sit back and watch the show. As you study Esther, you can see how active and involved they were in the whole ordeal, always trying to put God first and God's people first in the forefront of their minds, and how that they might serve God's people. And so we also need to wish to be active and used for the glory of God, to be doers of the word and not hearers only. And so we need to always be preparing ourselves like Esther was. She was faithful in those small things, right? She was obedient to the command of Mordecai as in her youth. And she endured the hardships that came to her one by one, time and time again. And so we too, as good soldiers of Jesus Christ, must endure hardship to be used for Him. And then we must be willing to do our part. Whether it's a great one or a small one, let God choose that part, shall we? Esther was faithful wherever she was. Whether she was just a young girl in the house or whether she was an older woman in the palace. And so you do your good work, knowing that it pleases God and that it produces fruit in the end. I mean, isn't it interesting to think that there would never be an Esther if there wasn't a Mordecai who did his part? Isn't it interesting to think that without an Andrew, there is no Peter? When I think about my mother, as I stated in a sermon before, without an Elma, there's no Justin, Shannon, or me. Her taking a stand for the truth and developing our lives has produced fruit. Two faithful preachers and one faithful daughter, active in the service of God. We need to be ready to do our part, no matter how small we perceive it to be, knowing that we've come to our lives for such a time as this. And trust God. He doesn't need a miracle to make it all work out. But those small events that we often don't think about much in life, He unfolds His plan time and time again. And so lastly, in the so what of the providence of God, is to depend on the Lord. Right? Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will what? Shall direct your paths. God saved His people then, and God knows how to save His people now. That's the star's story. It's a beautiful story, isn't it? A story of the weakness of men and the humble strength of the faithful. It's a story of the providence of God, that if you do right, live right, God will bring you out right. And yes, in life there will be clouds, and it'll look bleak and dark, where you can't see the end from the beginning, but you stand fast. And God will bring you out. God will show you the way. Hold fast and obey, for God will save his people. Thank you for your attention tonight. If you're not a child of God, won't you come and be a part of his people? What a special treasure it is to be one of the number. To be taken out of the army and grasp of darkness and Satan, and delivered into the kingdom of Christ and God, the kingdom of light, where he'll bring you out right. Repent and be baptized for the remission of your sins. If you're God's child and you've forgotten the way of righteousness, maybe a lesson like this would remind you that he spared your life to this moment, to this day, so that you could make it right today. If we can assist, won't you come while we stand and sing? Journey may be often drear. We shall see the King someday. On that blessed morning, clouds will disappear. We shall see the King someday.